We have much to be thankful for today. We're thankful to have Brother and Sister Alvin Hobby back near normal. Brother Hobby's making good progress, and they're here with us today. Brother Hobby and his wife are right here. Brother Hobby, would you all raise your hand so we can see you? And yes. You may want to speak with them if you would like. They'll be glad to speak with you after we're dismissed. They've been long-time servants on the field in Africa. He was burned recently, and you're aware of it, and contributed to his recovery. We're thankful for their being back with us. I'm thankful especially also for doctors like Tom Formby and all of those men of that profession in this congregation. What a blessing they are to us. They're men who put the Lord first in their lives. They're men who are sensitive. They're men who are good examples for us, and we're thankful for you, Tom, and all of you other men. We're also very thankful for our young men. You know, the body of Christ here is the home congregation of the Arkansas State High School Class B champions for 1976. And you know, God is honored whenever those of his children do well in any worthwhile and honorable endeavor. And we're just proud as punch of you. And those of you who are the coaches, Coach Barden and his staff, we couldn't be more blessed than we are with these men. And I thank God every time I think about these men who set the Christian example before our young men and lead them in paths of righteousness and lead them toward goals of excellence. I wish they'd all stand up, but maybe that'd embarrass them. And if all of them stood up, it'd take practically one side of this building. There's about 7,500 of them. How many? About 60 or 70 of you, aren't they? About that many. We're thankful for you. I see Bill back there blushing now, so I'll hush. There are a lot of other things I had in mind. Really, I'd love to say that we're thankful for, but give thanks for whatever may be that's closest to you and for whomever may be closer to you than others. And pray for all, and let's give ourselves to the Lord today and as always. From every source, I find myself being constantly aware and amazed at how God has made provision, adequate and constant provision, for our instruction and our development as Christians. In 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter and verse 11, he says that those things that happened to the people back in the times of the Hebrew age, that those things happened to them as a warning. And they were written down, they were recorded for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages are come. And then Romans 15 and 4 says that the things that happened before time were written for our learning, that we through comfort, or through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. So you see this double-edged purpose of God's Old Testament Scriptures. He says he gave them to us to warn us, and then he gave them to us to encourage us. And it seems that the sword of the Spirit in the Old Testament has at least two sides, one of warning and one of encouragement and hope. And a very significant passage or incident in the Old Testament that utilizes both of these purposes of Scripture is that incident in the life of David, King David, and his horrible sin and his blessed return to the Lord. You see, David was a man after God's own heart. As far as I know, there's no one else in the Bible that's described as a man after God's own heart. He was a man that was in tune with his Maker. And yet he's a man that lost his Maker. He lost his God. He lost his footing. And we find that this man of God who lost God, is held up as a warning to us in the Scriptures, and we're shown his example of sin, and we're warned to avoid that. But then we also find that the man of God who fell so low also was blessed by God to be enabled to come back to God. And that's given to us as an encouragement for those of us who sin and want to come back. Now we know why, and we know when and how he sinned, and we know when and how and why he returned. Both of these are all held, they're both held up, and all the contributing circumstances and reasons and causes are presented to us either explicitly or implicitly. And this morning we want to notice with you his sin and his fall. And then tonight we want to notice with you his return. And so today is going to be centered around this twofold purpose of the Scriptures, to give us warning and then provide us with encouragement. The only question that I want to ask today is, how and when and why did this great man of God sin? How did he fall so low? Well, it happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house. He saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I'm with child." Now that's the record of the initial sin. That's the record of the initial visible sin. And then the rest of that whole chapter is a record of the cover-up. And there was a very elaborate cover-up to keep this thing quiet. Her husband was away at war. David sent a message to Joab, his general, and said, have Uriah come home. And you know the elaborate procedures that David went through and all the machinations and the imaginations that David put into effect or tried to implement in order to get this man to go home and be with his wife so that the guilt of David's might be hidden. But the man wouldn't go home. Finally, David sent word to Joab and said, "Put this man up in the front line of the battle and then pull back from him, so that he might be killed." And so Joab obeyed his commander, his king. The man was put up in the front of the battle. They withdrew from him. He was smitten and he died. The message came to David and he was told, "The man is dead." And so David took Bathsheba to be his own wife. But it says that this thing that David did, it displeased the Lord. Now that was the actual sin, that was the actual, then the secondary sin and the cover-up and all, that's recorded in 2 Samuel, the 11th chapter. But then it's the circumstances that surround this that I want us to look at this morning also. The context reveals these circumstances. And the context tells us two or three things about this particular man and these particular sins of his. He committed a double sin. He took a man's wife, and then he took the man's life. Now, why and where and when and how did it happen? The context tells us, first of all, that David fell when he had arrived. I'm going to put that in quotation marks. He fell when he had arrived. If you'll turn back, and if you have your Bibles, I'll just ask you to turn back with me to 2 Samuel, the 9th and 10th, the 8th chapter, really 8th and 9th and 10th chapters. If you'll find there, first of all, look at the latter part of the 10th chapter. The immediate context simply tells about one of the last victories that David gained over his enemies. Verse 18 of chapter 10 says, "And the Syrians fled before Israel, and David slew the Syrians, the men of 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen and wounded Shobak, the commander of their army, so that he died there. And when all the kings who were servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them. And that's just entered into the records of the Hebrew nation. But if you'll turn on back, the record in chapter 8 is even more explicit than that. And listen to these things that show that David really had arrived. He had arrived militarily. They had arrived nationally. They were up on the top. They were on the pinnacle. They were the state champions, you might say. They were the champions among the nations. Listen. Verse 1 of chapter 8 says, "And this, after this, David defeated the Philistines." Verse 2, "And he defeated Moab." Verse 3, "David also defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rehob." And then look down in verse 13. "And David won a name for himself." And then look at the latter part of verse 14. "And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went." Verse 15, "So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people." So you find the great victories of David, they had to do with the people that he subdued. They had to do also with his own administration. This man rose to heights and to perhaps peaks of being equitable. He rose to a peak of being honest and just with his own people. And this was one of the peaks in David's life. But he went beyond that. He was not a man just to be just and equitable to his own people. Chapter 9 and verse 1 says that this man even sought out those who were his former enemies. David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" So he found some of the descendants of his former enemy, Saul, and decided that he would show kindness to these people. But that wasn't the extent of it. If you look at chapter 10 and verse 1, you'll find that his magnanimous character overflowed even to the people who were not Jews, but people who were Gentiles, people who were dogs in the eyes of the Hebrew people. Verse 10 says, chapter 10 of verse 1, "After this, the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his stead. And David said, 'I will deal loyally with Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt loyally with me.'" So the magnanimity of this man became such that it spread over and went over into the lives of people perhaps who had no reason to expect anything from him. And incidentally, that kindness was rejected, but that's just by the way. But the man, you see, had arisen to heights of great grandeur and of real greatness, of equity, of justice, and of magnanimity. But look back beyond that. In chapter 7, the whole chapter there is devoted to a confrontation between God and David. There's a spiritual plane to which David arose. He came to be a spiritual giant, and it's recorded in chapter 7 that God, by the way, said, "David, I'm going to make your throne a throne that will be forever and ever." He said, "There'll be no end to your throne. Your reign is going to be perennial. It'll be from now on." And this promise that God made to David caused David to be humbled. In verse 18 of chapter 7, it says, "Then King David went in and sat before the Lord and said, 'Who am I, O Lord God? And what is my house that thou hast brought me thus far?'" And he goes on then and humbles himself before God. And he concludes in the last verse of that chapter by saying, "O Lord God, thou hast spoken, and with thy blessing shall the house of thy servant be blessed forever." So you see, it was not just in civil matters or in matters of military might or just in matters of jurisprudence or justice or magnanimity with people. This man had achieved a standing with God, and he had actually sat before God and shown how humble and how penitent he was and how much he bowed before God. This is all in the picture. And you could say, well, that man, yes, he had arrived. And no doubt David thought perhaps that he had arrived. But I tell you, something had happened. Something began to happen. It was not during those days, whenever he was attempting to gain his name or attempting to gain his crown, that he had the problem. It wasn't during the days of his ascendancy that he was troubled. It came after that. It wasn't during the days of struggle or during the days when he was fighting. It was during that time after he had gained the ascendancy, after he had gained the throne, after he had gained his crown, after he had gained his name and won it, it was then that this thing took place, and only then. And you know, I'm convinced that one of the most dangerous times in your life will be that time when you have arrived. And I use that in quotation marks because I doubt that there's ever a time when you really have arrived. There may be times when you think you've arrived, but I'm sure that one of the most dangerous times in your life will be those times after the victory. Someone, it's said over the portals of a college somewhere, it says that on the plains of hesitation lie the bleached bones of those who on the verge of victory sat down to rest and resting died. Well, you say, but that was on the verge of victory. You never are in the victory line. You never really are there until you're there. In the Christian life, we're not going to receive the crown until we finally go and stand before God in the day of judgment. That's when we'll be given our victory crown. Why do you football players think that Coach Barden kept telling you, don't say that you're number one? He wouldn't let them say that they were number one until they'd gone clear through this final game of this series. Then they could say they were number one in Arkansas, but he wouldn't let them say that before. Because there's just something that happens to you. Your metabolism, something happens. Your adrenaline stops flowing. Whenever you feel like that you've arrived, you settle in, and then, by the way, there it happens. Someone wrote this, and they gave it to me some months ago, right when I needed it most. It served as just a good kick in the seat for me, and I had gone through 4 years of doing what I thought was really the very best that I could do here, and I had set my goal on 4 years. And I came out on the other side of the 4 years, and I was as lost as a goose. I didn't anymore know where I was going. And she gave me this, one of the, Neva White, Bill White's wife. She found this in a book, and unknowing, or not knowing my problem at the time, nevertheless, she brought it by the house and left it. She said, one of the most important lessons of life is that success must continually be won and is never finally achieved. Every day is one of test. Every day puts at risk all that has been gained. The greater the apparent achievement, the more serious is the risk of loss. The farther you've climbed, the more disastrous the fall. As well has well been said, it is not worthwhile to talk of the end of a period, for you're always at the beginning of a new one. You cannot rest content. That was by Charles Evan Hughes. And you know, that's true in the Christian life. You really can't rest content. This man's fall came when he had thought, at least, that he had arrived. And yet, that's when he fell. But a second thing, add to the fact that he fell after he had come to the point that he had arrived physically, militarily, and all these other ways that we've discussed. You add to that this second reality, that David was idle. He fell when he became idle. Look at chapter 11 and verse 1. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go forth to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him. But the last part of that verse says, but David remained at Jerusalem. Not only had David come to the point in his life that he had arrived, so to speak, but he came to the point in his life when he was uninvolved. He came to that point when he was idle. At the time in the year when most kings, it said, when kings go forth to do their battle, David sent someone to do his, and he stayed there on his couch. Now, I don't know whether he wasn't feeling well, or whether he just had the blahs, or whether it was one of those blue Mondays that just leave you, that just didn't want to go out to battle. I don't know what it was. But I do know that David stayed behind when he should have been out there doing his job. He was idle. David's life had always been active, even as a boy. David had been employed by his father to take care of the sheep. And the taking care of those sheep had involved killing lions and bears. David had said with his own mouth that he had killed the lion and the bear while he was taking care of his father's sheep. So his life had always been active as a young man. His life had been active as a young warrior. David's life as a warrior began with killing Goliath. What do you do for an encore once you've killed a man that's 8 or 9 feet tall? Well, his life then from that point on was a constant activity of battles and fightings, hidings in cave, chasing people, being chased. And all through the Psalms, you find this constant activity on the part of David doing battle with his enemies. And then as the young king designate, he was being chased by Saul.
was constantly in danger. But all of this, you see, added to the activity of his life. And it was during those years that King David wrote some of the most beautiful psalms on the strength of the Lord and the need of the human being. He wrote those psalms during his shepherd years, and he wrote those psalms during his warring years as a young warrior. And those psalms will outlast the ages. The psalms that David wrote have lived now for nearly 3,000 years. And they'll keep on living because they were written out of that period of time when David, in his struggle, was near to God. But today, he's idle. Doesn't have anything to do. When the time was that kings went out to battle, David stayed in Jerusalem. And you know, nature just simply hates a vacuum. We've said it, and I understand it, and you understand it. But so many times we don't really understand it until we sit in the middle of it and find out, by the way, you either row or you go. You either go upstream or else you start drifting back. There's no way you can stay in neutral and survive. You've either got to fight or you're finished. You've got to keep on going. My father told me years ago, you can put yourself on the shelf as a preacher any day you want to. He said, just stop studying. And he said, you'll be on the shelf and you'll be the one that put yourself there. Nature does abhor a vacuum. You plant a garden, and if you don't believe that the weeds will grow faster than the corn, just let it go in neutral. Like Neil told us this morning in the class. He said, I think I'm just going to start planting the weeds. That was an overstatement. That won't solve it. Because there'll be other weeds that'll outgrow the weeds you plant. You can count on it. You either go or else you don't. You go backwards. You either go forwards or you go backwards. That's what's called the law of entropy. There's a natural scientific law of entropy that just simply says any system allowed to stay on its own and allowed to just lie dormant, that system will deteriorate or it goes wild. It just completely disintegrates if it's allowed to stay just in neutral. And so David's second problem came when he was idle. But a third thing, you add to the fact that he had arrived, and then add to that that he was idle, then you add to that this third ingredient. David had reached that unusual period in life that we call middle age. Now, I'll tell you what, if the other two don't undo you, this one will. He had arrived at middle age. Now, I don't know exactly how old he was, but he was probably between the years 40 and 50. Youth has its problems. And most of the times we deal here in this congregation, probably 9 months out of the year, we deal with the problems of youth. But we recognize that we still have those problems ourselves. But what they don't realize is that we've still got all those problems, but we've got the problem of being middle-aged as well. The fierce battles of youth are certainly those that get to you. But a young person has that. It seems like that protective cover of he's so naive and he's such a realist that his realism protects him from some of the pitfalls that you and I as middle-aged people don't have to protect us. You see, we're too far from the source to be real sparkling, but we're too far away from home to really be well on our way. We're caught right in the middle, and we call it the middle-aged rut. And I'll tell you what, it's a dangerous period of time. Your glamour is kind of going, you know, if you're a lady. And you find yourself having to kind of prop yourself up and stay longer in front of the mirror. I saw a friend of mine yesterday, and by the way, he's getting old. He's aging. I went home talking about it. My wife said, well, you look at yourself. She said, if you could see those crow's feet in the middle, you know, out here in your eyes, you'd see who's getting old. But you see, your youth is beginning to fleet away. And yet, as Brother Helston said the other day, the last illusion that finally leaves us is that we are attractive. He said that's the last thing that we finally give up, is that we're still sexually attractive. And I guess that's right. And I guess when you quit dressing and when you quit dolling yourself up, you know, you're either out of your mind or you're on your way out, period. Middle age. You know, when most people, and someone said this, I can't prove this, but someone said that more people fail morally during the years 40 to 50 than at any other decade in their life. We're beginning to see that marriages fail during the ages of 40 to 50, perhaps as much or more than any other time in their life. Now, maybe I can't substantiate it, but let it be at least enough of a shock to let you see, by the way, that the middle age years are those very serious years. Let me read you something that I found. The temptations of life do not get weaker as one gets older. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, your battle with them will get fiercer as you get older. Our prayer should be, keep me from secret faults. Deliver me from presumptuous sins. An old man's heart is the devil's busiest workshop. Watch your heart then as you get older. Day by day, shut the door of your life. Close your eyes. Let no wrong imagination ever dwell in your heart. That's good advice, men. Women, that's good advice. And as you reach the middle age years, if you think that you've arrived, and if you think maybe now you've moved out into suburbia, and you've got a lot of time on your hands, and you're idle, and you're middle age, I'll tell you one thing, you're setting yourself up for a real dangerous confrontation with temptation. All of these things were those that confronted David. But there's a fourth thing that confronted him. And that was, and I'm going to state it the way I wrote it at first, and I'm going to take exception to it and deny it. His fall began with only a forbidden look. His fall began with only a forbidden look. But you know, that's not true. That isn't true. I don't believe David's fall did begin with a forbidden look. I believe that it began much earlier than that. Actually, the forbidden look and the subsequent lust and then the ensuing lying with that woman, all of these things were just the visible manifestations of a fall that had taken place in David already. I don't believe that a person can make that kind of a fall on such a short notice. I don't believe that we stand on such a precarious position in our walk with God so that one glance at an unclothed woman will cause a man to lust and then be brought into sin and be enslaved in sin. I don't believe we can do that on such a short notice. I believe something happened before that. I think the decline and the fall started way on back, maybe months, weeks, at least weeks and maybe months, and perhaps even a year or two in advance of what happened here. You want to know why I think that? Because of my own personal experience, as I find myself, as I struggle with sin, as I struggle with my own life, I find that things don't usually knock me over unless I have set myself up for them well in advance. Now you mark my word and you nod your head if that's right. That's right. You're setting yourself up. I think David's deterioration started months before this fall took him down. You know when he said that my whole heart pants for thee? Let me not wander from thy commandments. I have hid thy word in my heart that I might not sin. That was stated in one of the Psalms of David, but I suspect that that had been long past his attitude and long past he had already abandoned that. He hadn't thought about it in a long time. And the statement that we've incorporated into a song, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. David probably hadn't said that in a long time. And if you were to have gone to David that day when he got up off of his couch and was wandering around and watching that woman, if you had caught him before that and you would have said, David, tell me about your relationship with God. Tell me about the last, give me some idea about your walk with the Lord, the closeness of your association. Tell me about it, David. I don't doubt but what he'd start telling you all those times in the past that he'd been close to the Lord. I don't doubt but what he'd tell you about how the Lord had promised to make his throne an everlasting throne, and about all of his conquests of the nations and how he had been so kind to these people. I think he would have told you all those things perhaps, but I suspect that all of them would have been in the past tense. Past tense godliness. Well, David, what about today, though? What about this week? Well, let me tell you about what happened last year. The Lord and I... No, David, what about today? David, have you communed with God today? And I think that you would come to the conclusion that David's association with God was a past tense association. And so he looked, and he lusted, and he implemented that lust in his sin. He had arrived. He was idle. He was middle-aged, and he had set himself up for the fall. James says that everyone is tempted when he's led away by his own lusts and enticed. And then the lust, when it is conceived, brings forth sin. And the sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. And we see this documented all down through history. When Adam and Eve sinned, it was the same process. Eve looked at the fruit and saw that it was desirable. She took it and she ate it and she gave it to Adam. She looked, she took, she ate, and she gave to him. Achan, whenever they were assaulting the town of Ai, and Achan became involved in the sin that caused the death of some of the Israelites, and he was finally confronted with it. You know what he says? He said, "I saw it, I coveted it, and I took it." And then he went and buried it and tried to hide it. And that's the same process that you find David involved in. But here's something else. You see another process. Not only was this something that was a natural progression, but there was also a natural involvement that was an increased involvement. These two sins that he committed, adultery and murder. The first one of these sins, you might say, David, you'll have to be more or less lenient with him. He committed this thing in the very heat of passion. And that's right. He committed adultery in the heat of passion. He didn't plan the encounter. Oh, he did once he had been seduced, once he had been taken in. But he didn't plan her to be there. That he didn't plan him to be here. He was just simply in his neutral gear, walking around and saw it, and in the heat of passion he fell. And if there's any extenuating circumstance at all that could be extended for David to say, look, this thing, you'll have to forgive him. The circumstances just caught him unaware. But you can't say that about the second sin. Where the first sin was committed in the heat of passion, the second sin was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder. That's all you can say about it. I've never read any account of anything that was any more premeditated and any more cold-blooded than was this second sin of David's. Now, what is it saying? It just simply says this. That the progression of sin, not only does it lead you from looking to lusting to the action, but the progression of sin also leads you from sins of passion and sins where perhaps you're caught in the midst of that and you react out of the heat of passion, but you stay with sin long enough and you'll find yourself doing things that are premeditatedly wrong. You know they're wrong. And you begin to work out plans to cover up other sins, and you lie. And you do things that are just simply downright cold-blooded, premeditated violation of God's will. That's what David found himself in. David's sin was terrible. And that progression of sin ought to scare you to death. It scares me when I realize that you can't tamper with your conscience, you can't tamper with your soul. You can't dabble in sin. You can't send up flags. You can't make yourself ready. You can't set yourself up. You can't go that route. Because if you do, just as surely as you go that route, somewhere along the line, Satan will throw you a sin of passion. And then you mark my word, from that sin of passion, you'll begin to go the premeditated, cold-blooded route of rebellion against God. It's just as certain as one follows one. Here we go. And so the man fell. So we see this man after God's own heart, once so close to God that he could write this psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for thou art with me." That's the man who now stands before you in your imagination as you view him. He stands there with filth all over his hands and his garments drenched in somebody else's blood. Now, the warning that the scriptures give us is this: let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Now that's the warning. That's the purpose of telling it. That's the purpose of it being recorded. Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. Now look, I perhaps am talking to people who feel like they have arrived. We're middle-aged people. The majority of us here, that's the ones I'm talking to. Perhaps you think you have arrived. Be careful. Perhaps you're at that point then, having arrived, you're kind of loose end. You know, you're just kind of idle, kind of wandering around without really any purpose, not much to do. And then thirdly, you're middle-aged. And fourthly, have you been setting yourself up for a fall? You know whether you are or not. You know whether you're raising your flags. You know whether your quiet times have been in the past. You know how long it's been since you as an individual, son of God, have sat quietly with your Maker, with His Word in your hand, and with it being funneled into your heart. You know how long that's been. You know how long it's been since you sat and wept before God. You know how long it's been since you as an individual were on a rich and rewarding relationship with your Father. You know that, and I know it. And I'm telling you, just as certainly as it was last year, if that's the last time, or if it was last 6 months or last month, as long as it's any time other than today, you're on your way for a fall. You're not going to make it. Discouraging me. No, I'm not. I'm trying to scare the daylights out of you. The Bible says, look, don't think that you're going to be the first exception to that rule. You won't be. And as I point to you, I'm pointing three fingers back at myself. Now, will you do this as we leave here? Will you go home and eat a good dinner? And then instead of turning on the TV today, if some of these things have touched close to you or have been a shaft through your heart, will you please go into your closet today and get on your knees and listen to Nathan say to you, as God sent him to say to David, you're the man. You're the man. Oh, I don't mean that you're going to be found guilty of adultery or murder. Perhaps you've rid yourself of these things. But look, these are just two of the outstanding sins. There are a lot of other sins. You may have been abusing your wife and family. You may have been hardened so much against your wife that you just don't communicate anymore. Go home and get in your closet and get down on your knees. You may be abusing and neglecting your children. Go home and get down on your closet and get on your knees. You may have been such that you just haven't kept up your daily reading and your daily praying. It may be that all of your relationships with God that are really rich and rewarding, they're all in the past. You're the man. You're the man. You're the woman. Will you go home today? Eat something, perhaps, or don't eat. Fast. But then, don't you turn on that TV set today if you're in need of God. If you've fallen, or if you're on your way, or you see yourself along these stepping stones into what David fell into, will you go home today and bare your heart before the Lord? And then tonight we're going to talk about His return. But don't, please, please don't become calloused to where you think, oh, it doesn't make any difference anymore. It does make a difference. It could make the difference between your going to heaven and going to hell. May God bless us. Let's encourage each other with this startling, stark example of a person falling. And remember that God says these things happened to them as a warning, and they were recorded for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages are come. We're going to sing this song of invitation and song of encouragement. If there's one here today as a Christian who's in need of coming to state before this congregation publicly something, whatever may be your need, or if you're here and you're not a Christian, would like to confess your faith in Jesus and be baptized into Him today, this opportunity is for you too. But those of us who are Christians, let's look at ourselves in the light of this lesson today and take heed lest we fall. Would you come while we encourage each other?